Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Welcome back. This is G.R. Mobley, and this show is also sponsored by reclaimingtherepublic.org. Again, you are listening to the only show that asserts a constitutional solution to getting the general government back into the framework of the Constitution. And in addition to that, the lines are open, so I've made sure that that's happened today. And because once or twice so far since I've been doing this, I failed to do that or mucked it up. But that being said, the number to call in, if you want to call, if you got a question or you want to discuss something or what have you, that number is 215-867-8255, or it's 215-TOP-TALK. And so with that, let me kind of move through a lot of stuff instead of kind of going through the usual diatribe. I just want to point out that I do have that video out on reclaimingtherepublic.org where my podcast and a lot of content is. And I would just say that if you go and watch that video, it's on the Take Action page. Just watch the first 30 minutes and I'll walk through the argument for Republic Review and why we have to do this. And literally, we do have to do this because there is no way we're going to ever get our individual liberties and sovereignties back and get the government out of our lives unless we audit the Constitution and call for Republic Review. As always, I took a look out that window and I actually scanned the news, and there is still no sign that the federal government is going to unleash all of these tyrannical roles, responsibilities, and powers that they've usurped from us. And therefore, what we need to do is we need to take action. And that's why this show is on. And as soon as we really have some real traction, who knows, maybe GR can retire and ride out into the sunset with maybe a large crop of hot peppers or something. But anywho, I usually have an open question and or a standing question, I should say. But today's Friday, and what I'm trying to do is kind of leave the open question Friday type of thing, kind of like open lines Friday, if you've heard of those things before. But what's really important is that if you have a question, and you may think, you know, don't even think there's such a thing as a dumb question. If you have a question, feel free to call. Again, it's 215-867-8255. I will be getting into the Massachusetts ratification debates once I kind of go through some stuff here. And so I'm going to do the similar thing what I did with New York. I'm going to kind of give you the high level of this. And I believe that the Massachusetts ratification debate is probably the second best as far as getting into it. But you'll see as I go through the kind of gloss over it. And then we'll dig into some of the passages of some of the astute observations and or arguments that came out of the debates right there in Massachusetts. But we have this Red Pill Expo that is going to happen this month. And oh, welcome to June. Today is June 1st, right? And so with the Red Pill Expo, that is the 21st to the 23rd. So if you want to attend, go check it out. It's at redpillexpo.org, and I would just invite you to consider looking at, before you look at the pricing, look at the speakers, look at those who are coming, and understand that there is something to be said about attending these things, because the content and the people you're going to meet and get involved with, it is going to be it'll probably be a pivotal moment in your life. And who doesn't need a pivotal moment in their life? Anyway, let me get into some news because I want to give you the constitutional perspective on this. A judge agreed Friday to temporarily block the most restrictive abortion law, which I believe is the heartbeat law in Iowa. And so it is supposed to be taking effect, I believe, in July. Yep, next month. And under the agreement between lawyers for the state abortion rights and the groups, you will find that They have been arguing back and forth, and the judge has basically allowed this to be stayed. The advocacy group argues that the law is unconstitutional. So here's the whole hitch right here. Because they throw these things in there, they're baiting me. Because how can they make a state law over something that isn't within the Constitution an unconstitutional law? So they filed this lawsuit to block to block this law, again, which bans most all abortions if a fetal heartbeat can be detected. Basically, the state district attorney representing the case, I believe it's the attorney general for the state, refused to represent this case. And the attorney that is representing the case says basically they need to get this in front of a judge so that they can argue the constitutionality of this law. And I'll actually tell you that they're not going to be able to do that, because if you want to argue the constitutionality of the law, you have to actually prove that it is in the Constitution. There is nothing in the Constitution. And what they have to do is they have to go down this path of saying, well, we believe that there was this intent. The only way you can prove intent is by going to the ratification debates. That's why these documents are so important. You can clearly understand that what they discussed and what they didn't discuss will basically help identify precisely what kind of limitations and what they wanted out of this general government. Anyway, the attorney general, his name's Tom Miller, and he's the one that refused to basically defend the law, which is his job. So obviously, Iowa has a problem because they've got a lawyer that's not willing to cut the mustard in representing the powers that be, or I should say that representative government in Iowa. The Thomas More Society, which is a conservative Chicago-based law firm, has basically stepped up, manned up, whatever, and they're going to handle this defense for free. So that's good on them. I think that that'll be a big feather in their cap. But the interesting thing is, and how did they get here? The last election basically flipped full control of Iowa from the Senate and everything else into the Republicans' hands, including the governor, lieutenant governor, and so forth. And like, this is the first time in a couple of decades that they've had this position. And so my point is, how many states have you seen that have made these kind of flips but have never made these kinds of laws or really stepped up and said, you know what, we're taking the federal government on? And it's interesting that it's only the Republican Party, the Republican Party is the party of base. Now, I don't want to say dissent. It is the party that challenges the establishment and the usurpation of powers that have been going on. And so to me, that lends to one of the reasons why I've been very focused on the Republican Party more so, because they are the big dog out of all of the challenging parties, libertarian, constitutional, and so forth. So anyway, I'm very happy that we can find states that actually step up. And I am hoping that the state of Idaho steps up as Chad Christensen starts talking about Republic Review and auditing the Constitution, that they can start moving forward. And I'm even going to have much higher hopes for Wyoming and hopefully a few of these other really red states as I get more engaged in, not Nebraska, but the North and South Dakotas and so forth. And so as I typically kind of state this, and I want to reiterate this, that if we're not using the Constitution in fighting our battles, then we risk almost certainty in losing these battles. When I say the Constitution, I mean the unabridged Constitution with the ratification debates, because the ratification debates are clearly the filtering and the deciphering. It's the secret coder ring for what a lot of those things meant. And we don't have to listen to hyperbole from judges, jurists, politicians, lawyers, what have you. We have the clarity that comes out of those ratification debates. So anyway, if the if we're not using the Constitution as our shield and as our weapon, then we're not going to win. But if we do, if we start using it as our weapon and as our shield, we will win these battles. We will win the war. And let me see. I know that we kind of already passed over South Dakota's. The next state that's coming into the queue for hopefully a recommendation and or two, and I need to get out there and start pinging and bringing these folks down in Salt Lake and throughout the Utah basin, is the Utah legislature. So hopefully I'll find one or two that will be willing to sign a pledge and get them on board so that I have an opportunity and you have an opportunity to contribute and help somebody carry across that line a good challenge as well as a commitment to the Constitution. And so, actually, I'm really out of time, but one of the things I want to point out before I get into this, and this is really the overview, if you look at when some of these states chose to ratify the Constitution, I can tell you that it wasn't necessarily the easiest times in what they did, and I can give you some history on this, but I will tell you right now, Massachusetts held their ratifying convention from January 9th to February 5th, 1788. That is some pretty cold, austere weather back then. And they had to have been some pretty tough men to bear through that. And I will get into that when we get right back from our commercial break. So please stay tuned. And like I said, we'll be right back after this. Thank you very much. Did you know your overall health is connected to your dental health? As you get older, this becomes more and more important. If you're like me, going to the dentist can be terrifying. So for me to maintain my dental and overall health, I need a great dentist and staff who are sensitive to my fear, pain, and even my fear of the cost of dental work. This is why it took me almost 2 years to find a great dentist after moving into this area. Bottom line, I need a great dentist just to get into the chair, even for a regular cleaning. This is why I personally recommend Dr. Vaughn Tracy as not only a great dentist, but a great patriot and a dentist who cares about your comfort and health. You can find him at VaughnTracyDDS.com. That's VaughnTracyDDS.com. Then you can agree with me, it's great to have a great dentist. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to so that you can understand what we all need to do. I'm trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their Constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
So Massachusetts is typically known for some pretty harsh weather. Virginia is not known for pretty harsh weather. And it just so happens that in 1788, they had a pretty harsh winter that hit the Northeast and actually the Eastern Seaboard. Because as I read Madison's Pursuit of the Bill of Rights, as well as the Ratification Debates, there was a lot of books that were written about that. They talk about how harsh and how cold the winter was that year. And because during the same time that Massachusetts was doing the convention, Virginia was actually going through their election process of who would become delegates. Now, you got to remember that Madison was up in New York at the time, and they were saying, you better get down here if you want to attend this convention. He thought he was a slam dunk. He had no idea that Henry was doing everything he could to keep Madison out of that convention and was basically doing gerrymandering. And we'll get into that term today. But it was very interesting how this whole process was happening. And when Madison finally got down there, he actually accounted to having some real difficulty, him and James Monroe, because that's who he was running against. He was running against James Monroe for Congress, but he was actually running for his own county to be a representative, and it was stacked against him, and he really barely made it. But had he not gone down there, he probably would not have made it. It took him a little while to basically refute all of the false rumors that were out there contending against him and so forth. And he was pretty strong as a advocate against the Bill of Rights and was basically pushing the Constitution during this campaign phase, because in his second campaign for Congress, he basically became the advocate of saying, I will champion this, because bottom line, that was the thing that was the sentiments of Virginia. And he's always the guy that toted what the sentiments or the intent was. Like with the Constitution, it was very limited government. And he was the most consistent in recognizing that it was a very limited government. So anyway, as January 9th came along in 1788, a lot of names of who's who in politics, especially for Massachusetts, started showing up. Caleb Strong, Rufus King, and Nathaniel Gorham were delegates that actually attended the Constitutional Convention, and they were there, and you know why they were there, but they were there to help explain what things meant. Remember, I talked about New York, where the three delegates that they had, Lansing, Yates, and Hamilton, they really didn't stick around that much, and they had some issues anyway. They were more of anti-federalists than they were for federalism. Because only Alexander Hamilton was the guy that signed it. And I truly believe he was over his head because he did not understand. The way he explained things did not necessarily jive. He just got into theory and hyperbole. And I have no idea, as brilliant as the man was, he should have understood. But I'm not the only one. There are a lot of people that just believe that Hamilton was not the guy that was going to go along with the system. His first objective was to get you to buy into the system, and then his second objective was to undermine that system. And so anyway, these delegates were also joined by Fisher Ames, you've probably heard of him, and James Bowden, Francis Dana, and Mr. Parsons, the Honorable Mr. Parsons, and those men were defending the Constitution and explaining it. And as well as those men, have you ever heard of a guy by the name of John Hancock or Samuel Adams? They were there in attendance as well. And one would think that these guys would have been anti-federalists, but they weren't. If you understand Samuel Adams and his role in the Revolution and so forth, he was a very staunch, you know, against those types of controls. He was a huge supporter for liberty and so forth. And so just like the Virginia's who's who in the history of leaders for political thought, Massachusetts was also an epicenter for that brain trust, if you look at who was attending. The interesting thing, the one delegate that wasn't there was Elbridge Gerry. He declined to sign the Constitution, and a lot of Massachusetts, at least the folks in his county, didn't feel he was worth sending as a delegate. His county did not want to send an anti-federalist. They wanted to make sure that they got that Constitution through. And if you look at the counties, it was pretty much either an anti-federalist county or it was a federalist county. There weren't a lot of counties that were split when you go through the counting in the ratification process and so forth. So anyway, I got to point this out. Elbridge Gerry was the ardent advocate, just like Lansing and Mason. He was the Bill of Rights advocate up in Massachusetts. And I truly believe that really it hurt him. There's no doubt in my mind it hurt him, because he did not get elected into the first seat of Congress either. It was pretty hard for him. He did. He actually did, I believe. I'll have to check that out. I will report on that on Monday. But I'm remembering the Bill of Rights, and I think he actually was there, and he argued for some of the things in the Bill of Rights during that first session of Congress. Anyway, I digress. Within the first week of the convention, there was a motion made, and it was passed, that the Honorable Elbridge Gerry be requested to take a seat in the convention so that he can answer the questions of fact. And I want to point this out, that the people that was requesting him to be there were not the Federalists. And so he was going to be there as a spectator, not as a delegate. So they were basically asking him to come in as an expert witness for the anti-federalists. And so there was this motion was made and it was passed. And so they basically had him, and he was there for the term of the delegates, or I should say for the convention, the ratification convention. But the interesting thing was he made it to the floor literally, I believe the next day he accepted, made it to the floor. But after the 19th, he pretty much disappeared from any records. It's like his contributions just kind of went away. And it's not that he was necessarily absent or missing in action, but I will tell you that the anti-federalists had to have been a little disappointed for their real champion to, you know, not be as such an ardent opponent to the Constitution. The real difference between, I believe, Massachusetts and the New York anti-federalists is really more of the principle, because I believe that if you look at the key players in Virginia and in New York and in Massachusetts, Henry and Clinton, who were governors and the real power brokers for the state, both of those were really anti-federalists because they saw the Constitution as a threat to the state's powers, because now this federal government is going to be taking all their money. You didn't see that in Massachusetts. As a matter of fact, the Honorable John Hancock, who had been governor and was the presiding president over the ratification debates, was actually a Federalist, or in support of the Constitution. And so anyway, I'll just basically say that going through the debates, Gerry was kind of absent in any type of refuting and stepping up and saying, you know, any comments in opposition to what was being said regarding the Constitution. The other interesting thing about Gerry, and I don't mean to make this all about him, but, it's Gerry, not Gerry. And Gerry had a unique namesake or byproduct in some of his political endeavors. And I'm sure maybe one or two of you have heard of the term gerrymandering. That's where gerrymandering came from Elbridge Gerry, or Gerry. Anyway, because he refused to sign the Constitution, bottom line, he struggled for most of his career to overcome this. And again, unlike the Virginia Constitution and their ratification, I should say the Virginia ratification of the Constitution, the preamble did not get nearly the attention in Massachusetts as it did down in Virginia. And as you can tell, there's some music that's getting my attention. And unfortunately, I've got to go into another break, so it's caught me in mid-thought here. So when we come back, I'll pick it up again in a comparison between Virginia and Massachusetts on the ratification process. So we'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Thank you very much. Most of my listeners understand the importance in having strategic goals, but do you have a long-term strategy for your dental health? Too many people are only focused on whitening their smile. I understand the appearance of your teeth can give you confidence, but this can risk your future health in only addressing the cosmetics of your teeth, and many dentists will take your money just to do this. They say failing to plan is planning to fail, and if you don't have a long-term strategy for your teeth and dental health, then you need a new dentist. Every dentist provides a dental plan, but Dr. Tracy and his staff develops a strategy to help you maintain and restore your dental health to what it needs to be. To develop a strategy in maintaining your dental health, connect with Dr. Von Tracy, DDS.com. That's VONTRACYDDS.com. So you too can develop a strategy in maintaining your dental health. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
And so, like I was saying before we went into the break and before I lost my train of thought, Virginia really focused on the preamble of the Constitution. And most people can cite the preamble of the Constitution. I want to... And the other interesting thing is that you find that the focus of the constitutional ratification debates between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, their biggest argument was the Bill of Rights. I mean, there were other, I won't say that was their biggest right, but that was the real moral principle that a lot of the men at the Constitutional Convention said, I will not sign this. I'd much rather lose my right arm than sign that thing. And that was Mason. But here's the interesting thing. There is a preamble to the Bill of Rights, and most people don't even know that. But almost everybody can cite the preamble for the Constitution. And the preamble for the Bill of Rights, I think, is worth reading since we're talking about preambles. And this was done, again, in the very first session. It was done by the first session, I should say. And it goes like this. Congress of the United States, begun and held at the city of New York on Wednesday, the 4th of March, 1789. The conventions of a number of states, having at the time of their adopting the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers, that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added, and as extending the ground of public confidence in the government will best ensure the benefits or the beneficent ends of this institution. Resolved by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress, assembled 2/3 of both houses, concurring that the following articles be proposed to the legislatures of the several states as amendments to the Constitution of the United States. All or any of these articles, when ratified by 3/4, so it was like a not a smorgasbord, or, you know, I hate to use the term Chinese menu, or how you can mix things up and you want this, this, and this. And so they were actually able to ratify each individual amendment separately. And so anyway, let me keep going here. When ratified by 3/4 of the said legislatures, to be valid to all intents and purposes as part of the said Constitution. Articles in addition to and amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America proposed by Congress and ratified by the legislatures of the several states pursuant to. So the last stanza was literally just identifying that this is what was actually ratified by the states. And those were the first 10 amendments. But most people, you know, they don't understand what this is saying. And what this is saying is that as they were ratifying this, they felt a compelling need to demand for immediate amendments to ensure the federal government didn't encroach into every little facet of their life, like their right to bear arms, their freedom of speech, religious expression, those types of things. So it's really important that you understand that the tone of every single one of these ratification debates was being as I have been asserting, and as many people that understand history assert, the federal government was not to be trusted with all types of powers, that it was very limited, that they would never have comprehended that the federal government would ever allow abortions or to be even involved in making those decisions. Again, it was always limited by the jurisdiction, which was what was enumerated in the Constitution. And so there's no doubt in my mind, the framers are rolling in their grave as they see what is going on down here. But anyway, so Virginia was really focused on the preamble of the Constitution. And instead, up in Massachusetts, they were really concerned about housekeeping matters. How are they going to do things? And during the latter part of the first week, they went straight into discussing Article 1, Section 2, which is where they deal with the electoral provisions of the House of Representatives. So, and in contrast to New York, New York agreed to go through the Constitution line by line, and for the most part, they did. And so each of these ratification debates kind of have their own signature, especially those that were heated and contested with Federalists and Anti-Federalists. When you look at Delaware, again, it was a rubber stamp. It just happened. I think Georgia was the same way. And so it was enlightening to be able to see the true sentiments coming from these debates where there was truly a challenge to the Constitution. And so where annual elections end and tyranny begins was one of the prevailing thoughts of the time. And as a matter of fact, this is where they were talking about the representations. Massachusetts was pushing back and going, hey, we want annual elections instead of two-year elections and six-year elections. And so that was the traditional, like I said, the mantra for the Republicans and one of the first securities of a popular liberty. And so the first 2 days of serious debate focused on whether or not a two-year term provision in Section 1 was consistent with popular liberty, because they wanted to be able to, you know, vote you out that next year because they weren't happy with you, and they were going to hold your feet to the fire every year. And if you look at it today, just imagine what it would be like. And if you know a legislator, somebody in the legislative body, ask them, how would they like it if they would have had to run for election on a yearly basis? I mean, it would never get work done because they would be constantly in election mode, right? If you look at today, that's how it is. The delegates focused more on their attention on this section and Article 1, Section 4 over the second week. The first full week of deliberations on Monday, January 22nd, that was the start of the literally the third week, and they turned their attention to Article 1, Section 8. And you know what those, you know what that is. Article 1, Section 8 is the enumerated powers that Congress was given in those very specific clauses. And they concluded literally at the end of that week, January 26, with a discussion of Section 9. And so Section 9 is the limitations on the federal government. Those are very specific limitations that, you know, the ex post facto law, that is no bill of attainder and ex post facto laws shall be passed. That was in Article 1, Section 9. Article 1, Section 10 are the limitations placed upon states. And so it was interesting how they kind of jumped through this, because they just failed to really dig into the Constitution line by line, and they allowed themselves to wander a bit more than one would find in like New York and Virginia. So there's not a lot known about what was really going on, but the powers of Congress, articles received the 6 days of coverage. During those first 4 days of that fourth week, which was Monday, January 28th to Thursday, January 31st, the delegates covered the remainder of the Constitution almost like at neck break speed. Here they were just literally going through this, and there's really no record of discussion of anything about Article 4. And Article 4 was where they, and to me, I believe a lot of that stuff in Article 4, especially the guarantee clause, was just a no-brainer. I would find, though, that the guarantee clause and the two constituents and going through the Senate and so forth, but that there was none of that there. Either there was enough explanation by the time they formed this ratification debate, or it was just a common knowledge thing, because there's no doubt in my mind they all understood the Connecticut Compromise and Roger Sherman's articulating and identifying the two constituents, because Massachusetts reconfigured their legislative body into a bicameral, into a Senate and a House of Representatives, instead of the representatives of the, like, they had a very similar situation, or I should say configuration, like the House of Lords and the House of Commons up in Faneuil Hall. I forget the name of their legislative body, but it was like the House of Burgesses was down in Virginia. Either way, they were just getting these things, and it just didn't hurt their heads because they all understood these things. And that's what's amazing, because the amount of education or the parallels of education that they had in those days compared to today. I mean, I have to go through a lot of explanations when I talk about republicanism, constituents, bicameral legislative bodies. It just hurts people's heads in talking about that. That's because we're not equally informed like they were back then. Anyway, I've had hard break, so I'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Thank you so much. It's that time of year to get that dental checkup and cleaning. I know many of us are creatures of habit and we tend to settle for what we know, and many of us are procrastinators. I was that way myself with my past dentist, jumping from one dentist chair to the next. From all the hopping, I've learned that all dentists are not equal, and I would challenge you to consider checking out Dr. Von Tracy. I work hard to make a living, and I'm not one to throw my hard-earned money away on just a good dentist. That's why it took me a couple of years to find a great dentist. From the excellence of his staff to the quality of the work, Dr. Tracy is the difference. I know it's time to put standards to our loyalty, so I would ask you to give Dr. Tracy a try by setting up your next appointment with him. Just go to VONTRACYDDS.com or call them at 509-466-6614. Again, sign up at VonTracyDDS.com. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
And so one of the things that kind of stands out to me is how quickly they were able to get things done back in these days, because they convened the convention on May 27th for the Constitution, and they signed the Constitution on the 17th of September. And I will tell you, if you do any research on the Convention of States, they have it wide open. As a matter of fact, I will be one to tell you that there is no design in getting in a bunch of amendments so that they can fix the Constitution. I believe the Convention of States, and this is one of my real problems with them, is due to the fact that they have it's all kind of open-ended and ambiguous. Well, we're going to create this system and this process, and we'll maybe churn an amendment out once a year or something like that. And so if you understand what each of these processes were doing back in those days, they were limited on funds. I don't believe that there's an excess of budget for all 50 states for a convention of states to be occurring every year to literally become a whole new body of government that is literally just churning out an amendment a year or something like that. And to me, it seems like the machinations in the design of the COSP are one of those things that are more lent towards creating validity and creating a name for oneself than anything that would be even remotely associated to fixing the Constitution, which the Constitution doesn't need fixing. What we need is we need compliance to the Constitution. Once we get compliance, then we can start looking at, you know, doing the minor little tweaks and changes that I believe will fall out of the compliance. But bottom line, there is no intent in getting this stuff done and done on time. These guys went through this entire Constitution and ratified it. Almost every single convention did it in a month's time, practically. So that being said, near the end of the morning session of the 31st, this is when the recorder basically declares that the conversation on the Constitution being ended, Mr. Parsons, the Honorable Mr. Parsons, moved that the convention do assent to and ratify this Constitution. Of course, he was a Federalist, and so he was trying to hurry up the ratification. But the interesting thing is, this is where you can really see the leadership from Sam Adams and Hancock, from John Hancock, because some of the most interesting discussions at the convention actually takes place over this last week of the convention, or this ratification convention. And so there was an attempt to previously quiet I will say omnipotent, but there was very little involvement with Adams and Hancock until the very end. And they came in with this accommodation for what was called a compromise, suggesting, remember, I've mentioned this before, that Massachusetts was the first state to do this. And so I believe it was Hancock that actually made the recommendation, and Adams jumped on it as, you know, yeah, we need to do this so that we can ratify this. But they were the ones that created suggestions of amendments to be annexed to the ratified Constitution. So that became this huge debate. And, you know, a lot of people said, well, you know, what authority can we ratify a constitution in this convention and propose amendments? You know, I believe the Federalists that were trying to keep the ratification kind of pure. And I think that they quickly were converted. And this is kind of called the Massachusetts Compromise. And basically what had been proposed in the recommendation for these amendments and the conditional amendments were actually just became, because the Federalists wanted, or the Anti-Federalists wanted, just like in New York, they wanted conditional amendments. In other words, if these amendments don't get passed, then we're basically pulling out of the ratification. And so all three states were very similar. And when we get into some other states, you'll see how they kind of handle it. Some of them rubber stamped it, like I said. But the proponents of the Constitution urged for the Massachusetts Compromise as the debate started moving forward. Like I said, this was probably the most animated time of the convention, as Hancock, again, like I said, was the one that proposed this. And then Adams and Ames and others started coming through. And actually, this became the model, because every ratification campaign across the country basically followed suit by sending in recommendations. And as a matter of fact, if you followed the letters and the history of George, or not George Washington, but Thomas Jefferson, he was truly opposed to the Constitution because it didn't have a Bill of Rights. Then as soon as Massachusetts ratified and Jefferson caught wind, hey, That's a novel concept, ratifying and then providing amendments to it. He actually started supporting that. And some of that information was suppressed because during the Virginia ratification debate, they used a former letter of his where he basically said he was opposed to the Constitution because of that. And they didn't want to bring forward the other letter to somebody else that basically said, actually, I'm kind of in favor of this, and I think it's a good model to for each state to provide their recommended amendments. Anyway, there's some disagreement as to what the likely vote in favor and against the Constitution would have been at the end had they not had this compromise. But I will tell you that they actually had a very close vote. Some Massachusetts anti-federalists even suggested that they had the majority in 40 or more regarding not ratifying the Constitution. So just fathom that. They were not going to pass this Constitution in Massachusetts, and that could have been the domino effect. However, this Massachusetts Compromise, this brilliance of John Hancock, and for the proponents, roughly probably got enough delegates to change their mind and secured the ratification by 187 to 168. So just 21 delegates over the 50%, or basically 20, because had they lost 20, it would have been tied. So if you can get your mind wrapped around that, what ended up happening was they set precedents in Massachusetts by this compromise, and it actually helped. I believe it helped New York. I believe it helped Virginia and so forth, because it kind of set that model. I would also, I would probably be missing one of the better points if I didn't say this, that no fewer than 8 of the delegates who voted to reject the Constitution, including a very boisterous opponent such as Samuel Nason, Benjamin Randall, John Taylor, and William Widgery, these four, who were basically a part of the independent Maine movement, after the ratification, because they voted against it, promised to work with the constituents to support the Constitution. Patrick Henry did the exact same thing as the Constitution was ratified in Virginia. There's no doubt in my mind these guys were paying attention to what these other guys were doing, and they had nefarious intent, because that's exactly what Henry did. After the ratification, he started literally working with gerrymandering before it was named gerrymandering, so that he could make it so that Madison would not be able to serve in Congress. They were talking about possibly Madison being able to be selected as a senator, and Madison actually wanted to be a representative of the people. But when it started growing legs, and Madison going, hey, our people were saying, this would be a great prestigious honor. You can literally focus on what you need to for 6 years instead of having to worry about re-election and re-election. And Madison kind of, the idea grew on him, but then all of a sudden he realized that the entire Virginia legislative body was under Patrick Henry's thumb, and so there was just no way and as a matter of fact, there were a lot of people that were, I will just say, insulted in the legislative body, but nevertheless, they did their, what do you want to call that? They did what they were told, because they had to basically be, either they had somebody had some photos or drawings of them with, the wrong kind of people or what have you. But for some reason, Madison was excluded from the Senate, and he barely made it, beating Monroe for the House of Representatives. And it's amazing that Monroe and Madison, in competing against each other so much as they did, they were really good friends. Their friendship did get strained at a point in time, but that's a story for another day. As we're getting ready to go off the air for the terrestrial radio stations, I bid you farewell. Have a great weekend. And as soon as we're done with this farewell, I will be talking about what we're doing next week. Thank you so much. Well, of course, as we've covered the overview of the Massachusetts ratification debates, I'm going to get into some of the good, insightful comments that were brought forward out of these debates, so that you can have another treasure trove of citations in defining what the Constitution really is. I am creating a level of empirical data, a mountain of empirical data, that proves my point that the Constitution was very limited and defined, that the federal government was contained within a very tight structure and framework of the Constitution, and that they don't have unlimited jurisdiction and unlimited power. And with that, I am G.R. Mobley. I am reclaiming the Republic with your help. I really do need your help. And God bless. Have a great weekend. I'll see you Monday.